This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. The debate over gun control is back in the headlines after a graphic shooting captured on live television. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Vester Lee Flanagan, a disgruntled and disturbed former TV reporter, shot and killed two of his former colleagues, Allison Parker, a 24-year-old reporter, and Adam Ward, a 27-year-old cameraman, during a live broadcast in Roanoke, Virginia. The gunman described the June mass shooting at an African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina, as the tipping point for his own behavior. Meantime, his allegedly unprofessional behavior prompted several local television stations to fire him over the course of his career. The live televised shooting, which shocked the nation, was followed by the suspect's decision to post a video he recorded of the killings online as he fled police, marking a new and disturbing convergence of gun violence and social media. He then shot himself when confronted by police on a highway outside of Washington, D.C., and died hours later at a local hospital. Despite America's collective horror over gun violence, there is still a lack of consensus on what can be achieved. The powerful gun lobby, the National Rifle Association, continues to assert that new firearms regulations are not the answer. The NRA says we need to do a better job of enforcing current laws. The NRA also appears to be rejecting the most innocuous of proposals, a universal background check for anyone trying to buy a gun. Meantime, the governor of Virginia and especially father of the slain reporter, Allison Parker, are arguing for universal background checks and other gun prevention bills. In an impassioned opinion editorial in the Washington Post newspaper, the reporter's father, Andy Parker, says he plans to make it his life's work, trying to implement effective and reasonable safeguards against such atrocities happening again. He says, quote, "That means we must focus our attention on the legislators who are responsible for America's criminally weak gun laws that facilitate the access dangerous individuals have to firearms on a daily basis," unquote. Well, for more on the debate about gun control in America and whether or not the U.S. Congress will enact legislation to reduce gun violence after failing to do so after other violent shootings, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Harry Wilson is professor of political science and director of the Institute for Policy and Opinion Research at Roanoke College in the state of Virginia. In 2007, he wrote the book Guns, Gun Control and Elections, The Politics and Policy of Firearms. And Arkady Gurney, he's the Senior Vice President of Campaigns and Strategies at the Center for American Progress. And Arkady was the head of Bloomberg's Mayors Against Illegal Guns. And Harry Wilson joins us by phone from Roanoke. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Arkady Gurney joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. And welcome to you.
Thanks, Carol.
Harry Wilson, I'd like to begin with you over there in Roanoke, Virginia, where this tragedy occurred. Your reaction, have we ever seen anything quite like this before, a shooting on live television and then the posting of the horrific video online?
Well, I'm not aware of anything along those lines. As you mentioned in your intro, the convergence of gun violence and social media, new technology. And it is disturbing, would be a considerable understatement, that the shooter, and if anyone's watched the actual video, sort of was as careful in terms of framing the video as he was in terms of shooting his victims. It was a chilling thing to watch.
Arkady Gurney here in Washington, your reaction?
Yeah, I think it really was a stunning incident. And I think it was sort of a testament to how extraordinary incidents of gun violence have to be in order to get the public's attention. So if it's 20 school children who are murdered, like at the Sandy Hook School in 2012, that will get the nation's attention. If you kill people live on television, that will get the nation's attention. But unfortunately, I think our political system has trouble focusing on the broader trend, which is equally disturbing, maybe even more disturbing, which is that every day, on average, 33 Americans are murdered with guns, and another 50 or so die in gun suicides and accidents. So the scale of this is really quite remarkable in the United States.
Back to you, Harry Wilson, to address this very fundamental question. How extraordinary does gun violence have to be in America to get politicians' attention, the nation's attention, to actually do something. We've seen so many violent, high-profile shootings of innocents. Arkady Gurney referred to the shooting at an elementary school in December 2012. More than 25 children were gunned down. We've seen shootings in movie theaters. We saw the former congresswoman from Arizona, Gabrielle Giffords, gunned down, or rather shot. She survived at a campaign rally. Will this incident, live on television, captured on social media, be the impetus for more rational laws?
Well, I think that you have to look, first of all, at the complexity of the problem. And while we have a very large number of shootings and gun-related homicides in the United States, the number of both has been declining for about 20 years. People talk about the epidemic of mass shootings, and that is debatable, whether it depends on how they're defined, whether they're increasing or not. What's not debatable is that the number, fortunately, the number of murders, although still extremely high in the United States and the murder rate is high, have been coming down. That's one thing to think about. The other thing to consider is that the solutions are, as is true of many complex problems, the solutions are not simple. It's not simple to identify these people. It's also not simple to say, in a nation where we have a Second Amendment that's been interpreted to mean individuals have a right to own a firearm, not anything they want, but certainly the gun that this perpetrator had, that they have the right to own those for personal defense, you can't refuse to sell the gun to him. And he did, in fact, pass a mandated background check. So I know of no law that we could pass in the United States that would have stopped him.
Arkady Gurney, no law passed in the United States would have prevented this horrific and the other horrific incidents that we have mentioned?
Well, I think that's not completely clear. I think the facts of the case are still being determined. I think Harry's absolutely right that under the regular federal background check, which the shooter went through to buy the gun, he would have passed it. There are some other laws. One law that just passed in California last year and was introduced in the Virginia legislature but not taken up, called a gun violence restraining order, which is a mechanism where family members could, or law enforcement could, seek to get a temporary order that would prevent someone from purchasing or possessing a gun. That passed in California. Would that have made a difference in this case? Not necessarily, but it might have been a vehicle. Apparently, in the history of the shooter, there was employers who were trying to reach out and get this person help and concerned about his mental health. Maybe they could have reached out to family members or law enforcement through this mechanism. But I think the larger question is, you know, Harry's right, shootings overall and murders have been going down in the United States in the last 20 years. That is something that's very good. But the level of gun violence we have in the United States remains way higher than our peer nations. So if you compare the United States to OECD countries, we have average rates of overall crime, average rates of violent crime, but murder rates that are way, way above 4 to 10 times higher than our peer nations. And there's really no way to explain that without looking at the ingredient of guns. And so you're not going to prevent every shooting, but just because a problem is complicated doesn't mean you don't try to take steps. And I think a good metaphor is, for example, auto safety. You know, we made cars in the last 50 years 5 times safer for every mile driven. People are 5 times less likely to die in a car accident than they were 50 years ago. And it wasn't one thing that did that. It was a whole bunch of measures, from drunk driving laws to airbags to anti-lock brakes to better signage. Many, many, many measures. It didn't stop all car accidents, but we found a way to take something that Americans love, cars. We find a way to protect that activity, but make it much, much safer, and that ought to be the model for guns.
Harry Wilson, back to you. We could continue with the automobile analogy vis-a-vis gun control or gun laws. Talk about the impediments here in this country to legislation to reduce gun violence. You referred earlier to the Second Amendment here. We have the National Rifle Association, a powerful lobby, which actually is also bipartisan insofar as it's not just Republicans who are seen as against gun control, but many Democrats in states where guns are very prominent. Talk about also any kind of control by the federal government.
Well, Kara, I think you hit on several important points there. We do have the Second Amendment, as you mentioned, which does make firearms fundamentally different from automobiles. In fact, how we've made automobiles safer over the years, firearms, when used properly, are inherently dangerous tools. There's no question about that. But they are safe. Sort of, we have accidental shootings, but a situation in which the firearm malfunctioned and someone was hurt is very uncommon. So the product is, in fact, safe. The way it's used is obviously not safe. And I think people in the United States and outside the United States, from my perspective, often look at the National Rifle Association, the NRA, and they say, well, this is why laws are not passed. I think what people lose when they think only that way is that the NRA is not simply an organization out there giving campaign contributions, but the NRA is an organization that has, by their estimates, 5 million, by some other estimates, maybe 4.5 million members. That's not a small number of people, and whatever number of million who sympathize with them but are not official members of the group. So it's not a situation in which there's one organization that's preventing laws from being passed. There are people making arguments on the other side saying, A, we have a constitutional right to own firearms, and B, the laws that you're proposing will make life more difficult for law-abiding citizens to exercise their constitutional right, but will in fact have essentially no impact on criminals and people who, for whatever reason, have decided that the solution to their problems is to kill someone else, that they will still achieve that goal in one way or another. And certainly we saw that in 1995 in Oklahoma City, where Timothy McVeigh used a bomb to do much more damage than anyone could do with a gun. So again, I come back to the fact that there are people who are opposed to this. And another important point is that most Americans see these mass shootings as failures of the mental health system as much as, if not more than, related to gun laws.
Let me get Arkady Gurney to weigh in on that. So Arkady, what about that argument that, okay, we have the Second Amendment, we have many members, some upwards to 5 million, Harry Wilson of the National Rifle Association saying, look, this is our constitutional freedom. It's not really guns per se, it's guns in the hands of these mentally disturbed people, and that's a failure more of our mental health system.
The mental health first. I think, you know, there's no question that there are improvements that we could make in our mental health system, and we should make those regardless of the association or lack of association between mental health issues and gun violence. Overall, gun violence and mental health are not particularly associated, although it is true that mental illness and mass shootings are more associated than everyday gun violence and mental illness. So we should improve our mental health system. But if you look at, compare the U.S. mental health system to mental health system of peer nations, we don't have an extraordinarily different mental health system or an extraordinarily different set of mental health problems in the United States. We don't have much higher rates of schizophrenia or other sorts of mental health issues in the United States than exist in other countries. You know, some of the other factors that sometimes people point out, like violent video games or violent movies, you know, maybe it's something to be concerned about. But again, our peer nations like the same video games and watch the same movies. What's very, very different about the United States is the prevalence of firearms and the easy access that people with mental health problems, but more problematically, most of the time, people with criminal histories have to firearms. So it is, I think, appropriate to look at incidents like this and think, what are the things that we can do around mental health to improve the mental health system for many, many reasons? But it would be a mistake, I think, to look at these repeated incidents of gun violence and not address guns as one factor and probably a very important factor in what is driving the lethality of the violence.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Harry Wilson. He's professor of political science and director of the Institute for Policy and Opinion Research at Roanoke College in the state of Virginia, and Arkady Gurney, from whom you just heard. He's senior vice president at the Center for American Progress. That's a think tank based here in Washington. We're talking about gun violence in the United States in the wake of a high-profile murder on live television. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, or keep up with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Yutaka Nagano from Tokyo, Japan. Well, back to you, Harry Wilson, in Roanoke, Virginia, where this high-profile murder occurred on live television. Let's talk about what can practically be done or not at this juncture. President Obama, back in 2013, proposed that Congress pass a universal background check, for example, for anyone trying to buy a gun. Also, he tried to restore a ban on military-style assault weapons. One could argue that either one shouldn't really inhibit or in any way violate a person who has a clean background and wants to own a gun from doing so. But yet, this legislation was not passed. What's going on here in the United States?
That's an excellent question, and the answers are not always, I don't think, readily apparent. I think the opposition to the universal background checks is not really opposition to universal background checks. The fear is that universal background checks, if enacted, would have minimal impact on gun violence in America. That's not where criminals get their guns, and most of the mass shooters that we've seen have actually purchased their guns legally and not purchased them either through a gun show or from a private individual where one does not always have to go through a background check. So the fear is, if we get universal background checks and they do nothing, would gun control supporters simply say, well, we've done all we can do? And most gun rights supporters say no, they would then start coming after our guns, meaning the guns that are owned by law-abiding citizens. And I think that's why there's such opposition to that. Opposition to an assault weapons ban is both practical, I think, and in some ways philosophical. Practically, what we define as an assault weapon is, it's very difficult to define, but semi-automatic rifles are rarely used in homicides. Larger number of the mass shootings, but of the day-to-day homicides that we have in the United States, most of those are handgun-based. Most of those are very often, frankly, younger black males killing younger black males. Not exclusively, but that's largely where we see the statistics on both sides. Young black males are most likely to be the victims. They're also most likely to be the perpetrators. And the thought is, trying to prevent future sales of those guns would be futile. And we sort of saw that that was the case with the 1994 assault weapons ban, where guns that were already owned were grandfathered in, and we now have several million of them out there. In fact, now the market is saturated with over 300 million guns in the United States, period. You're not going to get them back. The genie is out of the bottle. I think you beg the question of, what are you going to do with the situation that you have currently?
We'll come back to you on that, but let me get Arkady Gurney to respond to that.
Well, I strongly disagree with Harry that there's not evidence to suggest that universal background checks law would not have a significant impact. In general, what we see in the United States is that the states that have the strongest gun laws have the lowest levels of gun violence. That's true of gun suicides, gun murders, fatal shootings of police officers. Study after study has shown that. Looking specifically at universal background checks, there are two studies from Johns Hopkins, one looking at Missouri, which had a universal background check and got rid of it. Gun murders went up by 20% in Missouri. Connecticut didn't have a universal background check and adopted one. Gun murders went down significantly in Connecticut, as did gun suicides. The argument that criminals don't follow the law, that's true. That's what defines criminals across any issue. But what we have without background checks is laws that are very easy to break. And since there are no background checks in the secondary market, it's very easy to go to a state like Virginia, which doesn't have universal background checks, and go to a gun show or a parking lot and buy guns, no questions asked. It makes it easy for criminals to break the law. And what we also see is, in the states that have the weakest gun laws, they tend to drive gun violence in the states that have stronger gun laws. While we do see that states with stronger gun laws have lower levels of gun violence, they don't have as low levels of gun violence as they could were it not for the problems that the states, that the weak gun law states, are exporting. So Virginia, where this shooting happened, is the number one source of guns recovered in crimes in New York City. It has been for year after year after year. It is the number one source state for guns recovered in crimes in Washington, D.C. So I think I disagree with the notion that gun laws can't can't make a difference. It is hard to pass these laws, but I think what you see in terms of the politics of it is Harry's right that the NRA is a very powerful organization, and it's powerful not just because it gets millions of dollars from the gun industry, though it does. It's powerful because it has many millions of committed members who really do believe passionately in the NRA's position on some of these issues. Though if you ask their own members, a majority of them will say that they support universal background checks. But I think that the politics of it are beginning to change. Last year in Washington State, by a 60-40 margin, voters adopted universal background checks as a ballot initiative. And you see, I think even in states like Virginia, the electoral politics of this are beginning to change. 10 years ago, when Mark Warner was the Democratic governor of the state, he was NRAA rated and was pushing weaker gun laws as a Democrat. Today, Terry McAuliffe has been a real strong advocate for stronger gun laws. I think that reflects some of the politics changing in a state like Virginia. And if the politics change in a state like Virginia, I think that's a harbinger of where things may be going nationally.
As we close, back to you, Harry Wilson, to look again at the politics of gun violence and gun control here in this country. Where do we stand now?
There's a big split in the United States. It's often an urban-rural split. I see it here in my state. You can see it in New York State, where the opinion in New York City is very different than opinion in upstate New York. And in major urban areas where crime is a major problem, people see guns very differently than they do in more rural areas, where people see guns as part of their way of life. People see guns as necessities in some cases, potentially protecting themselves physically, but also protecting themselves or needing them to hunt or to fend off animals if they're living out in very rural areas. So we have very different views of guns, and it breaks down very often, largely along party lines, because the parties have now aligned themselves pretty much urban versus rural in the United States, the political parties. But it's really an urban-rural split.
Urban meaning the Democrats.
That's not easily going to be solved.
And you're referring to urban, associating urban with Democrats.
Correct, yes. The Democrats are generally speaking, much stronger in the United States in states that are much more urbanized and even within more urban areas within the state. So the Democrats in my home state of Virginia are very strong in northern Virginia, the suburb of Washington, D.C., as opposed to the other corner of the state where I live, where we have virtually no Democratic elected officials in this part of the state, handful in the city of Roanoke. Outside of that, virtually none. The Republicans have very stronghold in those rural areas.
Well, Arkady Gurney, the last word to you on a topic that we'll unfortunately be discussing for many months and perhaps years to come. With respect to where do we go from here, what does the politics look like here in this country? You managed a coalition called Mayors Against Illegal Guns, led by former Mayor Michael Bloomberg and Boston's mayor. To what extent is this organization and others like it growing in strength, able to compete with the National Rifle Association? How do you see things playing out, and whether or not President Obama has any bandwidth or even any ability at this point to get anything done on this issue?
Well, I think that generally the infrastructure of the movement for stronger gun laws has gotten much, much stronger in the last several years. And that's not to say that it is yet matched what the NRA has been able to build up over the decades, but I think it is becoming a much more even fight. And I think what you see and what Harry described in Virginia in terms of the changing demographics of Virginia, you actually are beginning to see that all over the country in swing states. And if you think about the rising demographic groups, younger Americans, Latinos, voters of color, these are not the base members of the NRA. And I think what it suggests is that when you look 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years into the future, there's the potential that this change in electorate will begin to change the dynamics of an issue like guns, as it might with an issue like immigration or gay marriage or some of the other social issues, where you're beginning to see sort of across the board conservatives feeling more on the defensive. And I think guns is going to be part of that trend.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Harry Wilson, professor of political science and director of the Institute for Policy and Opinion Research at Roanoke College in the state of Virginia. Thank you so much for joining us, Harry.
You're quite welcome.
And Arkady Gurney. He's senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, a think tank based in Washington. And Arkady, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me on.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Bill Barber, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.